The Guardian.
Music Weekly, sponsored by Cartier's Love Day. How far would you go for love?
Greetings, one and all. I'm Paul McInnes, this is Music Weekly, and in the next 30-odd minutes, we'll serve you the following.
After all, don't feel like nothing, like walking away, like a mouthful of rain.
A piping hot interview with partners in folk rock Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanigan. A mezze plate of new music from Jay May, Jay Riotard and the Infidels. No Jay there. We'll wash it all down with the best of the blog and Facebook. But first, this week's big dish, our catch of the day. It's Portishead. That was Machine Gun, the lead single from Portishead's third album called Third. And here to explain the significance of the name is top numerologist Dr. Rosie Swash. Hello, Dr. Rosie.
Hello.
That's your best doctor voice, isn't it? You're not really a doctor. And we all know that they call the third album Third because it's the third. But while you may not follow numerology, and I hear you don't even follow your star sign.
No.
You do follow Portishead, don't you?
I followed them to Paris to see them play live for the first time in my life. They were absolutely brilliant. And it definitely brought the album to life for me, which I think, perhaps like a lot of people, I felt their moment had passed. Third came along, probably like the most visceral, atmospheric, interesting album out so far this year. I expect people to disagree with that on the
yeah,
blog.
Well.
I was quite excited to meet the people behind it and talk to Jeff and Adrian from the band. And the first thing that I wanted to know was, we'd just come to the end of their tour, were they sad or relieved?
I feel sad and relieved. Not relieved. Relieved's not the word, I don't think, because it's been an absolutely brilliant experience for me anyway, to play to people that have bought your record and know your record and illegally downloaded your record as well. You know, it's a completely brilliant honour. And I like the family of it as well. The crew we've got are amazing.
We kind of try not to make it kind of band crew divide, you know, because you're all kind of travelling together.
Obviously we don't eat together.
No,
or travel.
Or
together,
talk to them.
Or be in the hotel
yeah.
with them.
We
just take their drugs.
Yeah. And we've really tried to avoid taking any wankers out with us, because that can happen quite easily, and we've done it in the past, and it really fucks things around. Because then you get people who divide the crew, divide the band, just for their own kind of game, I suppose. I think that's actually the saddest part for me, because I'm not really into touring, and I like playing live with other musicians, but I don't like playing for people much.
What is odd, and you were at the Zenith gig, weren't you? And they're huge, those things, you know, it's quite weird for us. But what is even weirder, if you're playing on the stage, is that divide between, and I've always been, you know, incredibly aware of it, just having barriers and blokes standing with yellow earplugs rammed into their ears and
yeah,
with their back to you.
I think what happens is that you go into kind of rock and roll venues, they've got rock and roll lighting rigs, you need rock and roll PA, you need security, so you're instantly starting within rock and roll standardisms. And you find yourself doing it, and it's disgusting.
When you first come on the stage, the first three tunes traditionally is when photographers are allowed into the pit to take photos.
That's when traditionally you get the theatrics on the stage.
Yeah, we went to see Lenny Kravitz, God knows why, years ago. And as soon as he came on stage, he was like posing and lying on the floor and stuff. And then I thought, oh, there's millions of cameras going off. And then when they went, it were much more sedate. And I thought, you fucking tosser. You're doing that for, yeah.
If that's entertainment, though, that'd be like James Brown or whoever the fuck it is.
Yeah, it's better when it's James Brown, isn't it?
Yeah, it is better. Always better when it's...
But it's that rock and roll cliche, and what I was going to say is that you find yourself suddenly becoming part of that.
Yeah.
And you think, like, shall I throw some shapes, which I don't have anyway, for these guys? And I just think it's preposterous.
My problem is with live, you play a tune and you kind of go, oh, I was kind of into that part. And then the next night it comes round and you find yourself dancing in the same way or something. You just think, well, I'm really not into it tonight, but I'm doing this thing. I know that sounds worse than it actually is, but
yeah, it does.
But you just kind of go,
I'm not actually aware of you, fucking hell.
I'm really not enjoying this. And I don't really have this thing where I believe that there's this kind of mystique. I mean, they might be looking at us kind of going, well, oh, isn't that good?
You're a wanker.
No, I'm looking at them just going, this ain't that fucking good. It just ain't.
That's apparent, Jeff.
I don't know, it's just weird. What you do is that you want to make music to communicate, right? And as soon as you get into a place that is like that rock and roll, that all goes down the shitter, and all of a sudden you've got smoke and you're trying to make yourself look. And this is my problem with myself, is that you're trying to make yourself look. It's not sound better.
Yeah, I know.
Look better, and that's bullshit. I didn't get into the game for the, you know, to look better.
Anything I say now is going to sound completely wanky, but in many ways I have to get myself either in a bad mood or a altered state.
Yeah.
And no, I don't mean by doing loads of gack or whatever it is you have to do, or smoking a massive spliff. I can just go into some world, and that might be, there might be many ways of altering that, but when that happens, then that is, there's no better place really. And that's why it's so frustrating when you don't get there, and when you don't feel like you've done a good gig and everybody else is going, that was fucking wicked, and you're going, I was really out of step with it. I had one Wellington boot on and one off, and yeah, there's a great big fucking field of mud I've got to go through, you know. What was your next question?
See you later. I'm getting from all the things that you were just saying, because I am taking it in, is that what you two hate is the traditional aspects of the rock and roll performer, is it's all about ego, and that's what you can't reconcile yourself
yeah,
with.
Yeah, it is, but not as on a purely personal level. If Jimi Hendrix was still alive, I want him to have an ego.
But you can't reconcile yourselves to that.
I could possibly be that person. I'm not that person. Even though supposedly we, you know, we sell a lot of records and people are into us on that, possibly on that level, can't imagine it, but I can't see that. We were talking about festivals earlier on, weren't we? Like Glastonbury versus the world kind of thing. And one of the things I love about Glastonbury is walking around and seeing things that you would never see, like sculptures out of cars, and you feel like, fucking hell, there's a whole load of cars and they made a Stonehenge out of it, and there's this weird prehistoric monster made out of scrap metal, and it's just amazing. Going to Coachella felt like they dropped a lawn on a desert, you know, watered it with stolen water from Colorado or whatever. And then there's this kind of weird sculpture that looks like it's been made on a computer program and then put together for thousands and thousands of dollars to look really...
I bet it's arty. Not, I bet it actually is someone like... that is actually doing some really fucking cool stuff.
So what was it like actually playing Coachella?
Coachella was... I thought it was amazing, actually.
I kind of had a different take on it, really, because we went there the night before and it was like the raconteurs were playing and they sounded fairly dreadful. And the raconteurs shouldn't, because they're a good band. And it was just really weird. I thought, oh, no, this is going to really suck, you know. And then we had a sound check at like 7 o'clock in the morning, and we did the first sound check, and it was the biggest sound that I've ever heard in my life. It was truly amazing. But then the actual gig, for some reason, I just couldn't connect with it at all. It was just like the ridiculousness of being so far away from the audience.
Tell me about Chuck D and Primavera.
That was a real childhood dream. It was brilliant. I mean, we met him backstage at the Primavera, and I felt like Benny from Crossroads going into the Bronx, you know. It was like, Mr. G, Mr. Chuck D, will you have a rap order thing with you? It would be an honour. I said honour about 16 times.
I felt like Mr. Poshington Poshley had just gone in there and saying, that'd be awfully good if you'd rap on one of our tunes. I felt like that's what I felt like.
That was Adrian and Jeff from Portishead, and Third is out now.
I'm coming to the mind actually that you're something, you're set apart really. You have a special talent. I wonder, mate. I don't know. I wonder whether you were either abducted by aliens or anointed by angels as a child that gave you kind of the powers of interview.
Sandwich or whatever they call it?
You're going to get a kicking in the middle. No, I just wanted to say something nice to you because I always feel I'm a little bit tough sometimes. All right, there's nothing more to say, and I think we should move on lest Rosie starts to cry for one reason or another. Singles Club, it is then, the part of the show where we listen to music, rave about it, and then cast it aside before moving on to the next new thing, like a group of oversized teenagers. Joining us for this week's tunes is Luke Bainbridge, Deputy Editor of Observer Music Monthly. Hello, Luke.
Hello there.
You are a pod virgin today.
I am a pod virgin. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's probably a good thing. It means you've been able to stick to more reputable forms of journalism up until now.
This is true, but there's no place I'd rather be today on this sunny day than in this small, dark room with you.
Thank you so much, Luke. It means a lot. Let's move on and get cracking. We start with Jamie. This is Ill-Willed Person. You're long. That was Ill-Willed Person by J-May. J-May is really Jamie Searman, but she obviously thought it would make her look cool if you chose a new makey-oppy name instead. J-May is part of the anti-folk scene, which basically means they make folk music but pretend not to. The leader of anti-folk, if they accept such paternalistic ideas as leadership, is Jeffrey Lewis. Originally hailing from New York, J-May now lives in London. What's that all about? Rosie, J-May, do it for you? Yay or nay? Or indeed, May.
May,
I think.
Well,
that's kind of a middle one, you know.
I like this single. I am not really such a fan of the female anti-folk variety, her and the Joan and the Policewoman and the Emmy the Great variety. It's a little bit more jazz folk. The men tend to do the sardonic stuff. This song is very upbeat and I really like the melody and I love the pianos in it. Generally, though, she doesn't really do it for me.
Is that because she's more melancholy generally, or?
She's not particularly melancholy. She does a good impression of someone that is quite interesting, but actually her songs aren't that interesting, and that's what I find with a lot of anti-folk. It's like, aren't we avant-garde? Haven't we got loads of ideas? It's actually quite boring.
Luke, I was maybe, not for the first time in my life, a little bit glib in describing anti-folk as sounding like folk. What is it supposed to do with itself, anti-folk?
Well, I think there's so many female singer-songwriters around at the moment, it's not as if we're short of them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, J-May, for me, is slightly set apart. She's a J-Maybe going towards a J-Yay, because she just seems to have a bit more originality about herself and a bit more sort of waspish humour than a lot of her peers, I think.
Her vocals are very similar, though. They sound like, you know, Regina Spektor or, again, an Emmy the Great. Or it's difficult for people in this sphere to distinguish themselves from their rivals when the music's so stripped down.
I think she sounds like Joni Mitchell in this song and in a lot of
Wow.
it, actually.
That's high praise indeed.
Yeah. I think she does a good impression of sounding like. I'm not saying she's as good as Joni Mitchell. Perhaps one of the reasons someone like Feist has stood out from that crowd, apart from the fact that she made a very poppy album, is because her voice is really exquisite and amazing and unique, and this isn't any of those things for me.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but I would also say that it just seems to be funny that do you not find that a lot of the breakup albums, the American breakup albums, sound to sort of pull at the heartstrings more than British breakup albums for some reason, from Dylan's Put on the Tracks, and I'm certainly not putting this in that category or anywhere near, but to sort of Bon Iver's recent album. Maybe we just have a romantic idea of American breakups.
Well, that's right. Interesting. There was a lot of talk about that on our blog this week, about what makes an album sound American, and particularly what makes it sound foreign to a British ear. And I think there is something about that distance. And also there's a more elegiac element to the vocal sometimes. They don't mind dwelling on a note for longer or hitting a slightly higher range, which, I don't know, maybe that's just not the typically British fear of doing something out of the normal bounds. But that's a good point, although I'm sure Paolo Nutini would disagree with you about the classic breakup albums there. Okay, that's Ill-Minded Person by Jay May, and that's out on June the 16th. Second track on Singles Club is Always Wanting More by Jay Riotard. Maybe you piss from the things that you miss. You always need something more from them. Telling you things to kill all your dreams. It's your truth, it's not me. Okay, that is Jay Riotard with Always Wanting More. It may not surprise you to learn that Riotard, note the A, is not this artist's real name. He's in fact called Jay Lindsay. He hails from Memphis, Tennessee, and has not, so far as we know, relocated to London. He has, however, played with 9 different outfits in the past 10 years before hitting on a revised formula of garage rock he now calls his own. Should he?
For me, I'm afraid this is more of a Jay Nay, really. I mean, I hate to come across...
You should apply the J scale on every track.
I hate to come across as a sort of seasoned old hack, but, I mean, if I'm going to listen to melodic garage punk, I mean, for me, I'd rather just go back and listen to the Buzzcocks, Magazine, bands like that. There's nothing I can get from listening to this that I can't get from those bands, and it's not even doing an old trick in a new way, to be honest with you.
Why is this the sound of the now? There is a little revival in garage rock. Is it just because it's its turn?
Part of it is that, in this post-Libertines world, and I think this is much more popular in America than it is over here.
Yeah.
But for me, I just can't see it, really. I mean, I have seen clips of his live shows that do look quite incendiary and stuff, and he seems to sort of attack the audience in most of his shows, punching and kicking the audience and stuff, which is something you wouldn't get from Pete Shelley, the Buzzcocks, who would rather just sort of... complain in a sort of, you know, fey whiny voice about people spitting at him. So yeah, maybe on a live element there's something that, you know, is worth catching there, but on record for me, no.
Rosie?
Yes, I find him interesting. Someone said that he makes gutter level hits, I guess to say that he doesn't have hits, but there's definitely still underground. He's been involved in so many different side projects and incarnations with his band and had so many singles out. And I read earlier this year that he'd signed this deal with Matador where he was definitely going to put out 6 singles in 1 year, and then he was going to have an album out for them. That's, I guess, interesting insofar as it's abnormal.
Yeah, slightly too productive for your average band. That's something that's about his career or about his performance or about his character, but the music?
I don't think that you can separate the two. The idea of him, as he said recently in an interview, that what he loves about living in Memphis and making music there is that he exists in a vacuum. And he's been around for ages, and only really is he starting to get even that much attention, and that no one pays attention to what he does. I like the fact that he just trundles out these singles, these demo tapes, just whatever he wants, and doesn't seem to have any sort of career aspirations to it whatsoever.
You know, if you heard this song on the radio, you would be completely divorced from all that information, and surely the song wouldn't work with you in the same way if you didn't.
Yeah, maybe not, but I think that's why it matters. I mean, it's actually quite a poppy sounding track, and that's not evident of lots of his stuff, but it's to know that that person probably doesn't care and is just getting on with it. And by the time you finish listening to this song, they'd have made, produced or written loads of others. That in itself is quite interesting, I think.
Luke, do you have a kind word to say for artists who are prodigious in their output?
I don't mind it at all, but I don't think that's necessarily... a badge of merit to wear there. I mean, some people are more productive than others. That doesn't necessarily mean that the level of the material they're producing is greater or any worse, really.
Yeah. Always Wanting More by Jay Riotard is out on June the 16th as well. Final track on Singles Club is Free Things for Poor People by Infidels. That's Infidels and Free Things for Poor People. 5-piece from London, Infidels started out as a dance act who released their music from a bedsit on their own label, Dead by 30. Now well past 30 by the looks of things, they are signed to Wall of Sound, and their forthcoming second album was made with Megabox producer Youth. They now no longer make dance music though, Their new sound being described by guitarist Matt Goodison as having the energy and guitars of a rock and roll band like White Stripes, but surrounded in deep cinematic sounds. Rosie,
yes.
Where are those deep cinematic sounds?
I'm going to answer that by saying I actually really like this song, which I don't think any of us would have expected.
Anticipated, no.
At points, I was like, oh, this sounds a bit like it could be by Brakes, who, as you know, I like, or it could be by Snow Patrol. It's not really very much like the other stuff, as far as I can tell. And so I guess I kind of prefer this to the emphatic, jerky dance stuff that they do, which is all a bit kind of wacky but boring for me. But yeah, I found this quite heartwarming.
There is something about that little pulsing rhythm that goes underneath the track. You keep expecting it, one, to go on for 7 minutes and slowly build up with loads of little filters on top of it, and two, to end up in a crescendo, and maybe that's part of the atmospheric thing about it. Do you think this is a song waiting for a remix?
Not quite sure about that, because I wasn't a big believer necessarily of the stuff they were doing a few years ago when they were at the sort of forefront of this 90s dance rock revolution. But this more sort of straight guitar direction, I'm not sure is entirely for me either. Mm. I mean, they mentioned the White Stripes. And to me, it's much more closer to something like Snow Patrol, as Rosie mentioned. It's a much, much more radio-friendly, more commercial direction. And you can absolutely see this quite possibly being, you know, one of the surprise festival hits of the summer, I think.
And I used to hear Infidels a lot on the Eddie Temple Morris show. He's the guy who used to be the kind of avatar for the mashup scene. And the Infidels used to be part of that crowd. They used to do remixes around it. Does that crowd exist anymore? Is that all dried up of ideas, mashups, and this clash between rock and dance music?
The mashup scene, I think that was, if it ever was a scene in Quarter Square Mile in East London, it was never a thing that was going to have sort of massive longevity, I think. It was just one of those things that comes and goes. But as far as that wider remix scene goes, I think it is, and it's just always sort of changing in things. There's far more interesting things being done with sort of disco re-edits and stuff at the moment than there was with mashups maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But that remix scene is always evolving, and it will always be there, yeah.
Do you think there is a role for acts that try to straddle the divide between?
It's always difficult, isn't it? I mean, it always seems like a great idea at the time, but ever since the explosion of Acid House at the end of the 80s, bands have been trying to do it. We've more or usually less degrees of success, really. And it always sort of strikes a bit of fear into you when, you know, an indie band says there's always been a dance element to our music. It's just, oof.
Well, it's interesting you should mention the disco re-edits, because on the blog last week, where we ask you to file your reviews on the music we talk about, you got quite into talking about one of the acts, in particular the Presets, who are an Aussie electro group, and generally rubbed you up the wrong way. Floor Genius posted, "The comment about Aussie dance music being stuck in the 80s is very much on the mark, and is made even worse by the fact that the locals have a penchant for wearing fluoro to festivals." Podfave Marquis went on, "I don't think that being influenced by the 80s is a bad thing necessarily. The minimal techno and Italo disco of labels such as Italians Do It Better show that it is possible to do something new with an established sound. But the Presets don't have the, and I hate to use this word, edge that Glass Candy et al. Demonstrate. Whether it's a contrast in shade or tone, or whether it just sounds wrong and broken, these acts show that there is plenty of mileage in the decade yet." Rosie Swash, Rosie, who is that, do you know?
Some imposter
on the blog, some unknown, pondered what made Italo disco so good, and SV80 put an end to all discussion by posting the following. "I've always thought that Italo disco sounds incredibly chic. It taps into a sense of icy glamour that a lot of people born in the decade can pick up on. It's the kind of music that Vogue models should be making. It's also the socially acceptable meeting point of two amazing but critically derided genres, Europop and Electro Clash." Does that feed into what you were talking about there, Luke?
I suppose a little bit.
Yeah.
But I must admit, I missed that whole debate on the blog. I'm going to have to go back and look at it.
Maybe post a response. I'm sure people will be looking forward to reading it. Okay, so we want your reviews of this week's tracks. That's Jay May, Jay Riotard and Infidels. And you can post them at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. You can also review the following tracks compiled together in what we like to call La Montage.
You don't. was a boy. Well, I heard somebody singing, and I heard the guitars ringing.
Well, that's La Montage, and that's it for this week's Singles Club. Now, Luke, before you go, there's a new issue of your estimable magazine, Observer Music Monthly, out this Sunday, and I believe it's making the preposterous claim that world music is about more than a hairy old man playing a solo on the balalaika.
That's true. We've kind of billed it as a sort of new world music issue. I mean, I don't think it's particularly revolutionary in this day and age to say that world music is an outdated term. I mean, even back in June 1987, when the term was coined in a room above a pub at Islington, by a bunch of independent record representatives, which is a story you can read about in this Sunday's magazine. Even then, they knew it was a catch-all term that didn't really mean anything and didn't represent the artists concerned. But what they needed was a term that could buy them some space, important space in record shops,
right,
that would get them taken seriously by the music industry.
But in the end, does that come out to be slightly counterproductive, really, in that everything from the Balkans to...
I don't necessarily think it was, but, I mean, it clearly didn't then represent all the different artists correctly, and even more so today, I think. And over the last few years, with the rise of the internet, as people have come exposed to all different types of music and more readily available, then this music has got a much wider market. And you see artists, Western artists, embracing it much more than you would do. Mm-hmm. From Madonna, you know, appearing live on Live Earth with Gogo Bordello, to Damon Albarn collaborating with Tony Allen in Good, the Bad and the Queen. And, you know, even U2 recording the new album in Mexico.
Yeah,
you know,
and then obviously you've got artists like MIA and stuff who are involved in lots of different genres almost on every track. In your issue, have you found that there has been a crossing point and that actually there are a lot of artists who are not necessarily coming from any one tradition when they're making their music, or is it still West meeting East?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just a sort of all influences crashing together now. I mean, you'll find artists like CSS from Brazil who are exposed to all the sort of Western punk influences and American influences, but not necessarily aware of traditional Brazilian influences in their music. And then you get artists like Diplo who take influences from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think in this day and age, it is purely up to the artist to choose their influences, and it's not about where you're from necessarily.
It's about where you're at. And on that note, we'll say thank you very much, Luke Bainbridge, for coming in and joining us today on the Singles Club. I hope you enjoyed losing your pod virginity, and I hope you will come back and join us again. It was great fun having you.
Certainly will do. Thank you.
All right, next on Music Weekly. That's Rambling Man by Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanigan. She was the cello player in Emperors of Twee, Belle and Sebastian. He was the grizzled frontman of Grunger, Screaming Trees. When they got together, it was murder. Was it not, Rosie?
Yes, it was murder.
For you.
Wow, I can't remember the last time I had such chemistry.
in a room. Now, let's not kind of prejudice this interview too much, because we know what our listeners get like if you set it up badly. So tell us a little bit about why you wanted to speak to them in the first place.
Well, Isabel and Mark had their first joint album, Ballad of the Broken Seas, out in 2006, and it went down really well. They had the whole Nancy Sinatra, Lee Hazelwood thing going on with her wispy voice, and he's got, you know, sounds like Johnny Cash or something. And their second album was out, and I think I was quite interested in what was behind the collaboration. They're quite an enigmatic pair.
Because they go off and they do their own individual projects.
Yeah, and
meantime,
she still writes it all, and he just turns up and basically does what she says,
more
or less, which I found really interesting, and I wanted to sort of get behind that with them. He is quite a reluctant interviewee, a couple of grunts. Not too much more, but she can be encouraged to talk. So I got them to talk a little bit more about what makes the collaboration work for them.
I just really like the voice. Somehow it just sort of brings my songs to life and expresses what I'm writing about. And yeah, it's a good classic, strong voice.
What was the musical inspiration for the second album?
Bob Dylan, always, and Johnny Cash, and Dr. John, stuff like that.
You've both collaborated with other people and you're in other bands. What's the essential ingredients for making a collaboration work?
I think, just having an appreciation for what the other person does and having a common goal, just simple stuff like that.
Would you agree?
Yeah, but I think sometimes you can't take it for granted. Like, maybe I've got together with a musician and it's not been very good or something, and a lot of things on the first one just kind of fell into my lap, and I had to graft a bit harder for it than this one.
Fix up something to eat. Still water, still run deep. The dogs are barking now. Get back out on the street.
When it comes to the performing live, because you recently said in an interview you were quite effusive about how you feel about performing with Mark.
Oh.
Yeah, you said that it was like communing with God.
What?
Not you, I wasn't saying you were God. It feels very spiritual. I think music is very spiritual. Well, for me it is, and even writing the song, it feels like I'm going somewhere else to do it, and I really, really like that.
Is that reflected in the way that you choose to perform? Because one of the things I noticed when I saw you play was that there's an equal and special amount of attention for everybody on the stage. I mean, no one ever really talks about the people that are in your band, but they get as much attention as anyone else.
I'm not against a good show. Like, I like when James Brown does that thing with the cape, and well, when he used to do that, or Mick Jagger. I like all that stuff, but that's just not for me. If I were to do that, I would be like a fish out of water. I'd just be... it's just not in me.
The first album had a degree of critical success with the Mercury nomination. And how much does that impact on you when you come round to the second album? Is it something that's sort of nagging at the back of your mind, or does it feel like you can separate yourself from any unnecessary pressure? Or
it was quite nagging, but my main worry was that I didn't want to let people down. The most upsetting thing would have been for me if it had been like a lazy record, if I'd made a record and then people would say, oh, the first one was good, but this one, nah, it's not very good. Because I hear people say that about records all the time.
And the measure of the success of it for you is just how you feel about it now. Do you bother with critics' reviews and...
I don't read reviews because it's just not very good for me to read them. I think it's hard. I don't really have any perspective. But maybe some of the songs, I've maybe heard them back and I've thought, oh, I can't believe that I was involved in that.
That was Isabel Campbell with a grunt or two from Mark Lanegan discussing their album Sunday at Devil Dirt, and it's out now for you to buy.
Oh, very nice. Over to blogs. They got off to a positive start this week when Martin Cooling said, "V good pod this week." I like it when people do that. Maybe they could post a smiley face or something, that would be even better. I agree with the Rev about London being the centre of musical activity in the UK. It's annoying, to say the least. I live in Lincoln, which isn't too far north of London, 3.5-hour drive. That's well far north of London. But far enough. The most irritating thing is, and this happens a lot, that when bands announce they're coming to the UK for some shows, those shows turn out to be the Astoria and Brixton Carling Academy only. Luckily for me, Nottingham Rock City is only an hour's drive away and is hands down the best live venue music in the UK.
But Davis, 64, couldn't help but feel irked by the Rev, saying, "Whilst he has the best of intentions, I find John McClure to be extremely annoying, to say the least. It's strange. I don't think I disagree with anything he said in that quite brief interview, but dear God, did I just feel the urge to grab my iPod and skip to the end. That is especially true for the clips of the songs you played, as I find Rev and the Makers' State of the Nation electro indie pop stuff to be rather generic read crap."
I like that from David64. His fit of rage would involve him grabbing his iPod and skipping to the end. I'm going to skip to the end and nobody can stop me. From Frenzy, he was impressed by our other interviewee. He said, "I thought that this week's pod was excellent," like that, "especially the Mika P. Hinton interview and performance. However, he had a bone to pick with me. Paul Mac, I must pick you up as you misquoted me on the pod. You advised that I had said a new Danger Mouse album is out this year. I did nothing of the sort. I was talking about the second Mad Villain album, which is due for release this year. I have to confess, that was a goof. I had, of course, meant to say Mad Villain. I didn't say Danger Mouse. I'm very sorry, and I hope we can just, between us, agree to blame the producer. Anyway, over to Facebook. We've got some new friends. Jack Thunder, Daisy Pierce, Shaggy Younger, Christopher Wilcox, and Natalie Duncan-John, Lucy Royal, Alex Grossman, and Renato Machado da Silva, amongst others. Also, responding to our status, we'd written that we were trying to work out quite why Coldplay would say they were the seventh best band in the world, and wondering who the top six were. Liam Burbridge posted on our wall, and he just put down a chart. It read number 1, Slayer. Number 2, Slayer. Number 3, Slayer. Number 4, Slayer. Number 5, Crystal Castles. Number 6, Slayer. Number 7, Slayer. And number 8, Coldplay. And beneath it, he appended the legend, Scientific Fact. Thank you very much for that, Liam. Much appreciated. Remember, you can post on our wall, send us messages, or indeed chat around at Facebook or on the blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. That's it for this week. We're back next Friday. Register now to get the podcast sent straight to your computer or MP3 player for free. You can find out how at guardian.co.uk/music. That is all for this week. Thank you, Rosie.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you all of you listening out there, whatever time you're doing it. I'm Paul McInnes, and this is Bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Music Weekly, sponsored by Cartier's Love Day.